It was the eighth largest corporation in America at the time. It was the biggest bankruptcy in history, $1 billion, which today doesn't sound like much, but in that day was tremendous. And it was, in a sense, the Enron of its day. And from there on, it was just inevitable that government would have to step in and do something.
That's Rush Loving Jr. talking about the collapse of the Penn Central Railroad in 1970. Loving is the author of a new book about the U.S. railroad industry, The Men Who Loved Trains, the story of men who battled greed to save an ailing industry. He's our guest in this edition of the Middle Chamber Books podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Middle Chamber Books podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, the bookseller at Middle Chamber Books, and your host for these podcasts about books, authors, and other creative artists. The Penn Central Railroad bankruptcy in 1970 was the biggest business failure in U.S. history up to that time. It set the stage for the creation of Conrail, Consolidated Rail Corporation, in 1976. The government-owned railroad used to be a major employer in Philadelphia, which is near our studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. The Reagan administration privatized Conrail in 1987 after a bitter and public battle with Conrail's management, which opposed plans by Reagan's transportation secretary, Elizabeth Dole, to sell Conrail to the Norfolk Southern, a highly profitable freight carrier headquartered in the South, Mrs. Dole's home territory. In his new book, The Men Who Loved Trains, Rush Loving Jr. traces the history of the railroads that were folded into Conrail by tracing the stories of the men who ran those railroads, and in the early part of the 20th century, the railroad managers and executives were all men. Loving is a former associate editor of Fortune magazine who's covered the railroad industry for nearly a half a century. He currently lectures at the University of Denver's Transportation Institute. You can see a picture of Rush Loving stepping off a Norfolk Southern locomotive on our website, and you can also purchase his book through our bookstore at www.middlechamberbooks.com. We spoke to Rush Loving by phone from his home in Baltimore, Maryland. Rush Loving Jr., welcome to the Middle Chamber Books podcast.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on the program. The book is The Men Who Loved Trains, the story of men who battled greed to save an ailing industry. And Rush, this book takes its place in a line of almost legendary books about the rise and fall of the railroad industry. And the one that comes to mind most is, of course, Peter Benzin's book, The Wreck of the Penn Central. What made you think that it was time for yet another book about the rise and fall of the railroad industry?
Well, frankly, I've been watching this and participating in it, covering it for 35 years or 30 some years. And I simply saw this as a book that had to be written. It wasn't so much the timing as it was the as what I perceived as a wonderful story that people would want to read. And it certainly generated a lot of good comments. So I guess my guess wasn't too far off.
Take us back through the whole history of how this issue got started. The structural problems that led to the downfall of the railroads in the Northeast and the formation of Conrail were going on for an awfully long time.
Yes, and there were several different causes that all came together. After World War II, there was more use of airliners, meaning passenger trains were losing market share. More use of the private automobile, again, passenger trains lost market share. Meanwhile, the trucking industry was starting to erode the freight part of the business. And then interstate highways came in during the Eisenhower administration, and that just opened up the freight business for truckers. And immediately you could see the car loadings go down, the profit margins shrinking, because railroads have a lot of fixed plant, fixed costs. You got to have a certain volume in order to make any money. And then, too, in the Northeast, a lot of roads depended heavily on moving anthracite from the coal mines of Pennsylvania to the markets of the region. And anthracite mines were shutting down. So they were losing this real core of business, which they were created to carry. I mean, several of these railroads were anthracite roads, as they were called. And they began to go bankrupt. And then the illness just was spreading through the industry. Commuter costs were soaring. They weren't being reimbursed enough for that. They were under the yoke of heavy regulation by the Interstate Commerce Commission, and it was very unwieldy, unyielding sometimes, in letting them trim back enough to keep their revenues above costs. And so, one by one, they began to slip into bankruptcy. And, of course, the most stupendous of those bankruptcies was the Penn Central. It was the eighth largest corporation in America at the time. It was the biggest bankruptcy in history, $1 billion, which today doesn't sound like much, but in that day was tremendous. And it was, in a sense, the Enron of its day. And from there on, it was just inevitable that government would have to step in and do something. Now, I say inevitable. Most people didn't seem to realize that that was the solution. It took several very far-sighted people to push the rest into it. And a very interesting fact, the Nixon administration, which was in power at the time, was, like the current administration, a great believer in laissez-faire. But some of their people recognized the significance of the railroads in the region to the economy, and recognized that they couldn't just sell the railroads, the properties off on the courthouse steps, that government had to step in. Government had to create Amtrak to take the passenger business. Government had to reshape the tracks or the routes of the railroads in the Northeast, cutting off and shutting down those that were not profitable, and taking the rest and putting it, as they eventually did, into a single railroad, Consolidated Rail Corporation, or Conrail.
And that must have been a very difficult kind of a point of view for the Republican Nixon administration to take, ideologically, politically, philosophically.
It was, and the Secretary of Transportation gets a lot of credit for that. Claude Breniger, he was an oil man, had come in simply in the sense of civic duty, had taken the post, and when he first, realized he was dealing with this thing, his first instinct was to just, all right, well, let them shut down. But then some of the staff at DOT and his deputy, a lawyer named John Barnum, persuaded him that government had to get involved. And that's basically how it came about. It's too bad we've got problems right now with Amtrak and the passenger. We need to invest more in passenger rail in this country, but this administration just doesn't see it that way, like Breniger did.
One of the things in your book, Rush, and of course the title sort of focuses on the fascinating personalities that are involved, the title, The Men Who Love Trains. Talk a little bit about some of these personalities and who were the ones that seemed to be most interesting to you as you were researching the book.
Well, of course, there was Al Perlman, who had run the New York Central and became president of Penn Central, a great railroader who really understood his business and loved trains. Perlman, in his career, saved three railroads from either bankruptcy or near bankruptcy. A phenomenal man. And then there was, of course, Stuart Saunders, who was the chairman of Penn Central, who didn't give a whit for trains and presided over the downfall of Penn Central. Not all his fault, but nevertheless, he really didn't understand what the solutions to the problem in-house were. He did have a grasp of the Washington end of it, but not the operating end. Then there were people like John Fishwick, or Jack Fishwick, who ran the Norfolk and Western. Very colorful, very fascinating man. The story the book tells about the what's called Norfolk Southern, the Midnight Ride of Jack Fishwick coup, where they turned out the CEO and put Fishwick in. And then there were numerous colorful characters, including this young fellow who was the thread by which I told the tale, a guy named Jim McClellan, who is just, it follows him as he starts out of college working for the New York Central, and then ends up going through every major event that the railroads experienced during the last 40 or 50 years.
He's sort of like the Woody Allen Zelig character. He finds himself in all these major milestones in the industry.
That's right. In fact, he calls himself the Forrest Gump of railroading. Jim is a fascinating man, very self-deprecating, which is unusual in the railroad industry. And I needed somebody when I was writing the book. I needed, because I always write in terms of people, and I needed a person to follow through all this. And he was the one person who had been involved in all these events. So I finally, after about three or four drafts, finally found a successful way to weave him through it.
And he is now in a fairly high-ranking role at Norfolk Southern.
Well, he was. He's retired now. But yes, he was their senior vice president for corporate planning, was the brains behind a lot of the things they've done in the past 10, 15 years, and a man of great influence.
One of the stories that always fascinated me about Al Perlman is a story I heard when I was working for Conrail and had some time with Ben Gordon, who at the time was chief engineer of Conrail. Gordon was wearing a tie clasp in the shape of a self-propelled Bud car, with a jet engine on top of it.
Right.
Do you know about that story?
Yes, Perlman rode that car. They broke the speed record and ran it up in New York State on the water level route of the New York Central. And I think the record is still unbroken.
I think that's right. And the French apparently had broken the land speed record for railroading, and Perlman saw that as something that he had to compete with.
Well, and he did. It was very simple. They strapped a jet aircraft engine on top of the car and all got in it and took off. And, I mean, God knows they could have all been killed. Didn't matter to Perlman.
And it very nearly did take off.
Yes, that's right.
But they broke the record, and he was satisfied with that. Some of the other personalities, as we get closer to recent times, people who played pivotal roles in this whole process, and I had a ringside seat for a good portion of the privatization of Conrail when it was owned by the federal government and then taken into the private sector with guidance from Stanley Crane. Talk a little bit about Crane's involvement, how he got into the Conrail situation, and what happened with him and the government.
You know, Conrail's overseer, in a sense, was a it was a government organization, but independent of the administration of the executive branch, called the U.S. Railway Association, I think.
Yeah, it was USRA.
And the board of USRA was becoming more and more disenchanted with the management of Conrail. To the management's credit, its CEO had gone to Congress and persuaded Congress that they had to deregulate the railroads for Conrail to ever have a chance of being profitable. But there was a lot of disenchantment over the way the company was being run. People were unhappy about the constant need for operating subsidies from Washington. And so the pressure was on to replace the chairman. About this time, Stanley Crane retired as chairman of the Southern Railway, and they got him to come up and be the chairman. And he had one big advantage on his predecessor. He didn't need the job. He had a good pension and some nice executive perks, I think, from the Sullivan, and he could tell him to pack it in any time he wanted. And so Stanley went in there and did this incredible job of first going around Capitol Hill, meeting the key congressmen, getting them behind him, and this enabled him to stand off an attempt by the administration to shut Conrail down and sell its pieces. He then turned the railroad around phenomenally in very quick time. He got legislation passed to take the commuter costs off of Conrail's back, which was a terrible drain. It was one of the main contributors to their losses. The same bill removed some of the obligations to labor that were choking Conrail. And so within a year, he had turned the company around, and about 3 years later, Mrs. Dahl, Liddy Dahl, who was then by then Secretary of Transportation.
Who's now a senator from North Carolina.
Right, and the wife of Bob Dahl, who was then about to become the minority leader of the Senate. Anyway, she tried to sell Conrail off, essentially auction it. Crane opposed that because he didn't want some other company owning them. He felt that the company should be sold to the general public. He fought Mrs. Dole for 2 years and then won, thanks to his support on Capitol Hill. And Conrail was then put into a public offering, and the government had owned these shares. The government had basically had a majority ownership in Conrail, and so the government sold its shares to the public, and Conrail was a free company.
And one of the things that came up at the time, and I had a bit of a ringside seat for some of this part of the process, working in Conrail's public affairs department. The story that first broke, I think, in Institutional Investor magazine was the behind-the-scenes, you know, no-holds-barred, you know, throwing punches at each other story about a certain meeting between Elizabeth Dole and Stanley Crane. What did you find out about that meeting?
Well, there were several meetings. There's one where she dressed him down to the point where he came out of there looking ashen. And he told people afterwards that she spoke to him like she should never address a CEO of an American corporation. He was really outraged. I guess that's the meeting you're thinking of.
Yeah, the description in Institutional Investor said something like her makeup was melting and her hair was askew. And screaming at him, he slammed the door so hard that the clock on her wall either fell off or rattled or something like that.
I didn't know that about that part, but yes, I understand. And she was always impeccably attired, but yes, her makeup, he said, was running, that she was totally... her piece of hair started falling down, and apparently she was totally, you know, shaken by it. She certainly was raising hell with him. She was outraged. He had told the New York Times that he thought that Conrail should be sold to the public, and she just berated him, took him apart. That was the cause of the confrontation.
And after that, Conrail's board sort of gave Crane the green light to go ahead and try to position the company for an independent public stock offering.
Yeah.
And at the time that it took place in 1987, it was the largest initial public offering in U.S. history.
That's right.
The dollar amount today is a rounding error on IPOs. It was about $1.9 billion, which today means that's the fees the bankers get.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, the prices are much higher usually. After Conrail went public, there was a period of time where the company remained independent, and they went through a couple of leaders during that time frame. Talk a little bit about Jim Hagen's time and then Dave Levan as chairman of Conrail.
After Crane retired, they had one CEO come in, but after only a few months, he dropped dead of a heart attack. And they brought in Jim Hagen, who had been at USRA when they were creating Conrail, so he had been a marketing vice president at Conrail, senior VP actually of marketing and sales, and Hagen then had gone off to CSX, and was high up in the marketing area there, and they tapped him, brought him up, made him the CEO, and he did a superb job, as Jim always does. And then they were negotiating a merger with Norfolk Southern in 1994, and it became evident that this is going to take several years of involvement by Hagen to, you know, bring this off and cement it all together. And Mary Hagen, his wife, had reminded him that he had promised her that when he reached the age he had just reached, he was going to take early retirement and they were going to go skiing and play golf and all that. And so he finally just, plus the fact that many of his officers were opposed to merging with Norfolk Southern. And that was another crucial factor.
This was CSX and Norfolk Southern that were going to thinking about merging.
Well, they didn't get together on this till 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But this was in September, I guess, of 94, when he suddenly just said, okay, I'm going to retire. And Dave Levan was made president and CEO. Hagen stayed in as chairman until the next spring. And he told Norfolk Southern to forget it. But Norfolk persisted, tried to get Levan to talk to him. And finally, in the next year, they talked with CSX about jointly taking over Conrail and carving it up. Levan was very upset when he heard this, needless to say. That sort of fell by the wayside. And then in 1996, Levan talked with John Snow, the chairman of CSX, and they agreed to merge the two companies. And that led to a huge multi-billion-dollar takeover battle between Norfolk Southern and the two of them.
And ultimately, Conrail was purchased by the two, by CSX and Norfolk Southern, and ultimately they did carve it up exactly the way Crane had predicted would happen, going way back to the time when he was trying to keep the company independent.
The interesting thing is that Al Perlman initially had avoided merging with the Pennsylvania Railroad and creating Penn Central because he believed very firmly that the railroads, of the big railroads in the Northeast, should be paired off differently, that the Central should be merged with the Chessie and the B&O, and that the Pennsylvania should merge with its satellite railroad, the Norfolk and Western. That's essentially the structure that came out of the takeover of Conrail. Basically, what had been in New York Central went to CSX, the successor of the Chessie, and the Pensy part went to Norfolk Southern, which was a successor of the Norfolk and Western. It was a very interesting sort of wind-up of a long, long series of events.
It certainly was, and it's a very interesting history, and it's told in a very conversational style. Did you come across anything in the course of the research about the industry that surprised you, something that you didn't expect?
The book is a little tough on John Snow, and when I started, I thought that John was going to be one of the heroes, and the more I researched it, the more I felt that there were things there that my analysis said was, or my conclusion was, he was not as good a CEO as I had thought he was.
Now, John Snow, for those who are not as close to this story as you and I are, was the chairman of CSX Corporation at the time when Dave Levan was having conversations about a merger, and then it was Snow who made the deal with Norfolk Southern that ultimately led to the two railroads buying Conrail.
Right, and then he became Secretary of the Treasury.
Exactly.
In the Bush administration.
So he didn't fare too well in the book.
No, he didn't, and I'm really sorry he didn't, because I really like John. You always hate to do that sort of, you know, have to make that kind of judgment. But that's the job of a journalist. You take the facts and you analyze them and form your own conclusion.
Talk a little bit about the Penn Central. The Penn Central at the time was an enormous disruption in the U.S. financial markets, in the economy, in business in general. You called it the granddaddy of Enron. Why do you call it that?
Because essentially in size, and I'm talking about not just its size translated in today's dollars, but also its size within the corporate community of its day, it had the same essential size and impact that Enron had. Remember, in 1970, corporations were not anywhere near as big as they are today. They've been allowed to merge and merge and merge till they're Goliaths. So by the standards of 1970, this was a huge company that was, as I said, the eighth largest corporation in the country. And the world's largest transport company. Its tracks, well, its fleet of locomotives and cars would stretch from New York to Laramie, Wyoming, end to end. It had tremendous impact, and so a bankruptcy would also have a tremendous impact. A lot of insurance companies owned that stock, had owned Pennsylvania stock for generations, and there's a lot to be lost. And people feared that the stock market, which was not in its best shape at that time, would take a real hit if Penn Central were allowed to go into receivership. So, and that's basically why I call it Enron, the granddaddy of Enron, but that and the fact that they cooked the books just like Enron, and cooked them with probably more creativity than Enron.
What were some of the things they did to cook the books?
They had a number of subsidiary corporations. So they would take this one little subsidiary that didn't have much capital. It would pay the parent company this huge dividend. And then the parent company would give it back as an advance to the subsidiary. But the parent company would then record this part of its revenue, and it would bolster the profit or reduce the loss. Often it was covering losses, huge losses. And they did this, you know, all kinds of gimmicks like that. They had one called the Washington Terminal Dividend. The Union Station in Washington was jointly owned by Penn Central and the B&O Railroad. And it was going to be turned over to the government as a visitor center. So they created a new corporation and took the stock from the new corporation. When they did, the B&O just recorded it as, you know, at the same value as what it had on the books already, because it was nothing but a paper transfer. But Penn Central upped the book value of that stock to what it claimed was the current market value of the real estate, and then claimed that as new income, meaning a profit. I don't know if I'm explaining this very well, but it's a fairly involved transaction in some ways.
And how long did they get away with that?
Well, they had the same accounting firm that B&O had. The accountants let the B&O do it and let Penn Central do it their way.
So it just ended up being a pile of debt, and all of a sudden one day they weren't able to keep turning it over. Is that pretty much it?
They ran out of gimmicks. And, in fact, at the end were trying to get cash just because they were running out of cash, and they were trying to sell $100 million of bonds. And a very smart Wall Street lawyer sensed that something wasn't right. And as a result, Wall Street got very cool to the sale of the debt, and that was their last chance to get any more cash. They turned to the government then for a government loan or a government guarantee of a loan, and that fell through due to the opposition of some of the Southern congressmen. And those congressmen, the administration was depending on their votes to support the Vietnam War. And the administration couldn't afford to lose their support on that because of Penn Central.
Turning to the future, Rush, what do you think is likely to happen now that the dust has essentially settled around the Conrail acquisition by NS and CSX and the way they've divvied it up? What is the prognosis for the railroads in the United States? Do you think they've got a shot at staying alive?
Oh, I think the prognosis is very, very good. Norfolk Southern has been doing very, very well. I understand some of its traffic is down now, but they've also been paring out low-profit hauls. CSX seems to be getting its act together. It's doing much better. And, of course, all the railroads, including those, are being helped immensely by shipments of containers and trailers that they really didn't have that business 30 years ago. Didn't have any of it to speak of. Nowadays, it is the biggest commodity they carry is what's called intermodal, which is particularly containers moving from the ports where the container ships come in into the interior of the U.S. or even across the country to ports on the next other coast for transshipment to either Europe or Asia. So it's a booming business, and the coal business is booming bigger and better than ever, except export coal. And it's really I think a golden future.
And just to close the loop on one of the colorful characters in the book, Dave Levan, who was the last chairman of Conrail before it was sold, has gone into essentially a retirement and sort of an unconventional lifestyle. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Levan was unconventional to start with as far as railroad CEOs go. He was married to a very smart young woman who was a ski instructor. They lived in a converted fire station in downtown Philadelphia where he kept a collection of Harley-Davidsons. And they'd go ride motorcycles on the weekend. When he was doing the final negotiation with CSX, the lawyers called him this one Saturday, found him out in the mountains of Poconos riding his Harley. And he had to ride that motorcycle into New York, into Manhattan, in order to meet with Snow and make the final arrangements for their merger. Levan was an incredibly good man with the troops. He'd go out to yards and meet with the workers, and he was very hands-on. And he also was a great believer in his employees and his shareholders. And he really stuck to that loyalty when the battle was going on between Norfolk and CSX, and was very, very faithful to his people.
Levan is now out in Gettysburg selling Harley-Davidsons.
That's right. He took his money and used some of it to open a dealership in Gettysburg, and I understand that it's doing very, very well.
Rush, when you were doing the research for the book, and I'll wrap things up with this, did you how many of these folks did you actually get to talk to?
I guess 200.
Were they willing to talk about the Conrail experience candidly?
Yeah, they were. Many of them were very candid. Some refused to talk on the record, wanted to talk not for attribution, which we did, and were very helpful. Gave great insights.
Listen, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk about it. The book is The Men Who Love Trains, the story of men who battled greed to save an ailing industry. It's published by Indiana University Press, and our guest today is Rush Loving Jr., who is the author of the book. Thanks for being with us, Rush.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I wish you and your listeners well.
Thank you very much. We hope you enjoyed this Middle Chamber Books podcast. If you did, please tell your friends, or better yet, send them a link to the program so they can enjoy it too. If you have comments or suggestions about our podcasts, please email me at steve@middlechamberbooks.com. We'd be pleased to receive audio comments as well. We'll use them in a future podcast, so feel free to send an MP3 file. Our theme music for this podcast is Cook the Books from the Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra, one of the PodSafe music selections available at garageband.com. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.
This podcast is a proud member of the New Jersey Podcasters Association.
Hey, you got a problem with that?